Hey there, welcome to the Cause and Effect podcast, where we talk about the human stories and lives of entrepreneurs and change makers. This is your host, Ryan Buchanan, and I'm here with my mom, Sharon Buchanan. She's one of the most loving, engaging, dynamic, and entertaining people I've ever known. Mom is also the entrepreneur and founder of an art consulting company called Artist Circle that she started 48 years ago and has since recently passed that on to her partner, Jack Devine. But Mom is also the center of the family and has made a name for herself as a true leader in the art community in the greater Washington, D.C. area. Welcome to the show, Mom.
Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful to be here with my son.
It's great. One of the reasons why I decided to have you on the show, because we mainly have Oregon entrepreneurs on the show, one really unique thing in the Cause and Effect podcast interviewee community is that we are starting to do these digital happy hours among the 30 or so folks that entrepreneurs who I've interviewed with. And what we start off with is, especially in today's world with the whole coronavirus and the world has completely changed in the past 4 to 6 weeks, is what's good in your world? And when I answered that question, as we went around in a circle on a Zoom call like this with the 30 of us, I immediately went to family, because we are lucky to have an amazing family, and you and Dad are a big part of creating that. And so I just thought, hey, now that we're all staying safe at home and we're doing these Zoom calls all the time, why not start to interview folks who aren't in my backyard and are in the Washington, D.C. area? And what better entrepreneurs to start with than you, Mom, and then Dad will be a close second interview after this. So excited. Okay, so I usually start these interviews off with how I met the person. And so I was wondering, since I don't really remember the first time we met as well as you might, I was wondering if you could tell me your memories of when we first met.
Absolutely. You were actually a pre-planned arrival, because you were having such a nice time staying inside that you didn't want to be birthed. And so you were 2 to 3 weeks overdue when your dad and I hopped in the car one Saturday morning, mm-hmm. and we're going to go down leisurely at 6 a.m. to the hospital. And you were going to come out, have a coming out party then. But you wanted to make it a little more dramatic. And so as we were driving down with no traffic on the road, your dad got a little anxious to get there and started speeding. And we were pulled over by a policeman. And my husband turned around and said, if you ever wanted to act pregnant, right now is the time to do that. Or act like you're in labor, is what he said. Mm. And so the police, looking at my stomach and the basketball shape of it, believed us, and he gave us an escort so that you could be born mm-hmm. in the hospital. And it was a very wonderful, dramatic moment. That was the way you came into the world. And you have had so much attention since then. Two sisters, four grandparents, and all 11 female girl cousins. Mm-hmm. So you became known as that boy. And they all looked at you as the oddity, because you were the only guy amongst us. Mm. Anyway, that was kind of a little fun drama of your beginning.
Do you know that your granddaughter, Emma, has in her phone, whenever I call her, that what comes up is Dad the Attention Seeker? which is not very flattering, but
that kind of started out at the very beginning. Yeah. So
yeah, there we go. Well, you have been known for telling dramatic stories, so I think you're even tame on this one. So
that was not a falsehood, that was a reality.
Yeah. Event. Okay, so we're just gonna dive deep right away. And you and Dad are both in your mid to late 70s, and you've got 15 to 20 amazing years left on Earth. What do you want to be remembered for in your life?
You know, I gave that a little bit of thought, and what came out is that I get the most pride and joy, true joy, out of seeing you and your two sisters grow up into the caring adult individuals that you are. So in truth, it was parenting that I think I felt as much sense of things happening in a good direction as anything. And then beyond that, I would have to say that it was trying to develop a company of my own. And that happened gradually through, while I was in our first few years we spent in Japan. And during that time, you're in a very aesthetic world because Japan is just, has a sense of aesthetic and beauty through all of it does. It's culture, whether it be the flower arranging or clothing or just in every sense of their life. Came back to the States and volunteered at the Corcoran Gallery of Art as a docent. And you just kind of see the evolution of how this company got started. The third thing is I met artists through that docent period of time. And I opened a weekend gallery in Georgetown called the Art Garden. And that was a lot of work and not quite as much reward because you had to put it up and take it down every weekend. Then from there, I started determining what I could do that would be of interest to a large segment of the business community in terms of artwork. And that meant architects and interior architects and designers. Those were the people that had the office buildings during that period of time going up in the 1970s. And they needed to have something to enhance and enliven their lobby spaces and hallways, reception areas, and interiors. So I developed that artist circle fine art through working with architects and designers. And over the course of time, we were able to interest more and more people into using a consultant who could, the difference in art consulting versus a gallery that had been the only place you could buy art before, had to be receptive to the 10 to 20 artists they had in their gallery. Whereas an art consultant could find art from all over the United States, it would take it into the CFO or the CEO's office and show them the artwork. And so they didn't have to just presuppose what something might look like. So over the course of time, it was much more logical that people would want to work with an art consultant. Mm-hmm. Now that we have digitizing and being able to virtually show artwork, it even makes it easier. At the time I was doing it, it was extremely physical. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you were walking around with large pieces of art and taking them into spaces.
In your wood paneled station wagon.
In the station wagon, one of the classic things that went on was, it was a snowy day and Bob, my husband, was helping me load the car. We had 50 pieces of art to go down to DC to a large office building, or I did. And He then said, here, I'll show you a great way to get around traffic during the snow. And as he came to over a hill and saw that the snow and people were jammed up, he put on his brakes and I, of course, bumped into him, plowed into him. And so the people in front and back jumped out of their cars looking at what had occurred. And what they saw is two people talking to each other like they knew each other, like, why did you stop so early? And the other one said, because I had to. And I said, and I had to smash into you because you were spinning around in the road. Anyway, it was a great family argument in the middle of this road in the snow.
Mm-hmm.
The best part about that whole story is we went to the insurance company, and my husband came in after I did, and they said, oh, so you're the one that caused the accident, because I'd gotten there first and told them my part of the story. So it was an Abbott and Costello look.
Funny. Yeah. Well, I just wanted to show, if we do any of the video for this, this is a book that I made for you on your 70th. And when you answered the first part of that question, I wasn't surprised that family was first, but I also, so what I did in this book is throughout the 70 years of your life, I went to about 50 of your friends and family members throughout your life and asked them to tell stories about you. And I think what I thought you might have said in your response is that you led a very full and adventurous life, and like the last thing you'd ever want to be thought of is boring. So you're the least boring person I've ever met. Do you think that would be part? Like, I think also your friends, you've nurtured them in such a way that they've felt like family too. I think it's bigger than just your nuclear family that you've impacted. Would you agree? Well,
I think that part about not wanting to be boring, I think that for me, from the time I was very young, I didn't want to be expected or just go in lockstep with what the community around me thought would be the proper and appropriate thing to do. I wanted to experience things on my own and really explore and learn from the people that you would reach out to and the places that you would seek to go to.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we'll get into that. I mean, you grew up in Oklahoma where it's, you know, has this traditional Southern culture, and you are this dichotomy of, following some of those, the Emily Post etiquette and the, you know, debutante and all of that, but then also being a tomboy and going to Africa for a summer in college and doing things that no one else in Oklahoma would ever dream of doing. So I'd say you kind of have both.
Well, that's been part of my life, is I always wanted to, I wanted to see things around me in an experience in my own way that went beyond what was supposed to be the proper and appropriate little thing that a child and a girl child. I guess I didn't follow the lines of wearing my white gloves and patent leather shoes because I wanted to be out romping around and following the kids in the neighborhood. I think something that you're going to allude to in the Oklahoma years is that from a very early age, when we lived in a small bungalow house in a neighborhood where every one of the other kids was a guy. And so there were 13 boys and I was the only girl, and I was always trying to keep up with my brother and all of these others. So I would do whatever it took to be front and center in that world. Mm-hmm. Whether it meant to go to this open lot and field and build forts and then have dirt clod fights, or go down to the, we would actually in the summertime get old cardboard boxes, big ones. And with Oklahoma, the grass is so dry that you can slide on it like you could snow in the winter. We would spend time in doing that as well. So we, and then there was fences that you would jump off of. And I know that you had mentioned in one part of a discussion with me earlier about Daredevil and wanting to do things that were kind of beyond the possibility of what most people thought could happen. So when I was 5 years old, in this house we lived in, there was a little garage that you would put a car or your tools in. It wasn't all that tall, but it had a tree right next to it. So my brother said, you know, Sharon, if you were really good at tree climbing, you would climb up that tree and then you would swing over and drop on top of the roof of that little thing. I said, no problem, I can do that. And so I got up, swung over, jumped on the little roof, and my mother came out and was apoplectic, and she said, but she was very calm because she didn't want me to fall off. So she said, Sharon, can you come down? I would like to talk to you about something. And I said, well, sure, Mom, let me just figure out how to get down from here. And so then I swung on the limb, jumped into the tree and popped down. And she said, don't ever do that again. So I did one more time in a larger house in a larger environment, and that was a little foolhardy.
Well, I don't know if we'll get to this later in the interview, but your mom, she lived with us for 11 years when I was 8 to 19 when she passed, and because she had a stroke and she was mainly blind, and so we both were. It was great to share that part of your life with you because she and I became kind of best buddies because she was at home all the time. And she's just the sweetest thing you'll ever meet. Just never, what is it? If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
That's right. And then she always thought you were up to old Billy Ned because you would tease her and just get her to where she would almost want to say something that wasn't very nice.
She had quit.
No.
I did get her, yeah. And then I did play with her, the underarm fat on her arm sometimes. Just, it was so cool. And yeah, she was sweet.
Loved the attention, but she just liked to do a little bit of fussing to make
you're it. So rebellious, and then I got that rebelliousness from you. Like how she was so sweet. Like, did you get that from your dad?
No. My father was just a heart of gold, and he wouldn't hurt a flea. And mom had a real sense of the importance of being kind, and at the same time, she taught through explaining the right and the wrong of things. She didn't leap to judgment. She would let me make a mistake, and after I had made that mistake, she would say, would you come in, and I'd like to talk with you. And so during the course of talking with me, she would tell me what could have been done in a different way and how she perceived it and the way I should perhaps think of things in the future. So mm-hmm. It was a learning lesson for her. It wasn't just do as I say.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to jump around a little bit before we dive into your some of your adventures as a young girl in Oklahoma City. But I know both you and Dad are entrepreneurs, and we've got a bunch of entrepreneurs in the family. And I know you are very much kind of a leader, and you've had to be very straightforward and forthcoming about sometimes being dismissed as an entrepreneur who is a woman, especially starting your business almost 50, you know, in the early 70s. So I just wonder, you know, what was that like back in the 70s, starting a business from scratch? And were there any specific, you know, there's two parts of it. There's, you know, for any obstacle, there's an opportunity. But I just, like, how was it in those first, you know, few years of starting the business when there weren't a lot of other women business owners and entrepreneurs creating something from nothing back then? So what was that like?
You had a number of women that were starting to go into professions, law professions and doctors, but I didn't have that as an example in my life. So I had to determine what of my exposures and interests in life would come to that, could be developed into something. And so with the advent, as I had mentioned, of seeing a sense of aesthetics in my 3 years in Japan, and then coming back and having a real interest in art through through the volunteer work that I did with this docent program, where we went into the gallery of the Corcoran. And so, as I said, I have this stable of artists, and we have huge development going on in the Washington area. How can we enliven and enhance those spaces so they don't have that, what used to be the old hospital corridors, which were just very antiseptic and austere. And at this time, banks and law firms and developers for the lobbies of their buildings were starting to determine that they wanted to make it an inviting environment for people to be in. When you come into the reception of a bank, you wanted to feel that they had been there for a long time, and you could entrust your money with them. So that was a reason for art in that situation. So I started talking with art. I would go into various interiors and architects, and they would start to have an interest, but the difficult part was they didn't value my time. So I might be staying in the waiting room of an office for an hour and a half, just to get in to show them that they should be thinking in a different way. Gradually, that became an advantage for them to have art consulting as an adjunct or a service within their sphere. And so for the developer, it was being able to lease space and sell an office building by virtue of having a beautiful custom piece in their lobby that could make it stand out beyond other art office buildings. But the physicality of what I chose as a profession was something that I didn't count on initially. And so
because they're big art pieces, right? And sometimes sculptures, and you were sure, not only consulting on what would go in an office or a bank or things like that, but you are also often installing the art, correct?
Right. But so one thing with large sculpture, you would have to present by slide presentation, something that's hardly known today as we've gotten into the digitizing of everything. But one, I would carry two or three portfolios that had 50 to 60 pieces of paper art in them, as well as showing the slide projector and for sculpture. And then the installation aspect of it, which was having scaffolding, putting up scaffolding, hanging artwork from ceiling, hanging 30-foot piece on a granite wall that had to have diamond bitted drills and take 3 to 4 days to install all of it. So I have always had more of an engineering detail interest in that respect. Mm-hmm. So that was something that you have to learn, because the artists are telling you how complex and how important those pieces are. Then plus you have to be interested in lighting so that you show the artwork in its best aspect. So there are a lot of different components that go into it, but it was a gradual thing. And I think that the interesting or the somewhat easier thing for me than it would be today is that I went into that process in the very early stages of when it was being an accepted profession. Whereas now you have to jump into it full blown and know all of these things in advance of getting into it. Mm-hmm. So that in the Mid-Atlantic region, there were few, if any, other art consultants. And still, I say that my success could only have been in a relatively major city. So it was New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Houston, Dallas, and perhaps Boston. Those would have been the areas that had the ability to sustain that.
Just because the type of sophistication and number of large banks and law firms and really high-end places that were going to spend the money on art would, you know, really value an art consultant to be there, versus like in Portland, we don't have a lot of marbled, like very sophisticated buildings until maybe the last few years.
Well, but I think that now we have seen consulting has followed the evolution of development, and and as art has changed, galleries are having a more difficult time because the client can go to the online and you can seek out whatever art medium and artist you might be looking for, and you can do your own shopping that way. So what has happened with the art consulting profession as it is becoming more important for healthcare and hospitality. So you needed it for hotels. You need it for, let's say Kaiser Permanente has a big 6-story building, and you're waiting, you as a patient are going into that facility and you have to sit for a long time. And so you need a little something to focus on or make you take your mind off of what you're waiting for in terms of a medical appointment. So the artwork has taken on a meaning that is beyond just kind of prettiness for pretty's sake. It serves a purpose. Mm-hmm. And then also the other thing that art consulting has gotten into is there are many communities, and interestingly enough, it started with Portland, Oregon, in that Portland, Oregon was the first city in the United States to have a percentage of art in public places. So whether it was 0.5% of art or 1% of art, they would say to the city or to the county or to the developer, if you're going to develop this project, you have to come before a committee and show us what you're going to do for the community in terms of a visual piece of art. And so that is what we have on the East Coast now, following that protocol from that inception back in the 1970s, I believe it was.
Didn't know that. Mom, do you want to mute your phone real quick?
I did. I turned it off.
Okay. It's okay. Thanks for doing that. But when you were a little girl, did you ever think that, when I grow up, I'm going to be an art consultant?
No, I wanted to be a cowgirl. And that was probably the most exciting example I had, because when we were little, we would play cowboys and Indians and play outside all day. And so that was what was exciting when I was 4, 5, 6, and 7. And then as I got into high school and got more of a knowledge of other places and other cultures, I wanted to explore, just as I had when I was little, I wanted to explore other possibilities beyond the realm of Oklahoma. And that's when I became more interested in perhaps being an anthropologist or going beyond that into to engage with different cultures. Mm-hmm. And so the art world never came into play directly until my first year of college in New York. And curiously enough, at the time that I was growing up, other than the Oklahoma Cowboy Hall of Fame, there was no art museum in Oklahoma City. There was very little art per se there. People would travel elsewhere and bring it into their sphere, but there wasn't anything. So when I walked out of the subways into the city of New York for the first time and was exposed to not only the architecture and you think of the Rockefeller Center and all of the Diego Rivera and art it had, you think of the galleries that you could see anywhere you went. That was my first knowledge of art in that kind of setting. And then from there, I took my first art course at the University of Oklahoma. And then from there, when I was taking a semester in Vienna, Austria, I studied quite a bit of art at their museum, the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Europe. So I started seeing how truly art spoke to the spirit of people and cultures all over. And now, if you were to travel to Papua New Guinea or India or various countries in Africa, you would see what they do as an expression and a need to express their art in the way they live every day. There's a group in South Africa, I believe, that paint their huts in the most amazing designs. And then you might not remember, but in when we were in,
Tanzania?
Mamyar. What is
it? Oh, in Kenya?
No, Mamyar.
Burma.
Burma was the old name, yeah. And we went to Pagan. They wove their houses in the most intricate ways you have ever seen in your life. And they were then written up in books that traveled throughout the world because they were so unique in the way they expressed their art.
That's cool. So what, you're sharing all of these influences that ultimately led you to where you went. And I wonder, a lot of these are really positive things that build on each other. This question, you can go either way with it, but what's one of the biggest obstacles or moment of extreme independence that you had to overcome in those in the 18 to 25 year old zone of graduating from high school and and college, and then right after is, I'm guessing you're going to talk about Tanzania, but maybe not.
Well, I might get there, but I'm going to be a little more circuitous in speaking about it, in that, you know, you've gotten me off on the art aspect of life. But before that, in my high school days, in the 9th and 10th grade, I experienced the civil rights movement in a peripheral way, because Oklahoma being placed next to Arkansas, there was this Governor Favis that had to make a decision when in 1954 they came out with a federal law that there could be no more segregation in the schools. And so in 57, when 9 kids, African-American kids, walked into a segregated school in Little Rock, Arkansas, Favis called out the National Guard and shut down the school system for the year. That was the only way he could figure to do that. I've since learned that Favis was probably one of the more liberal politicians, but he had to pander to his base. So that's why he did what he did there. How does that affect me? Because kids from Arkansas came to our high school. And then I started reading about it. It was front page of the papers every day, that led me to have more interest in political science. And so as I as I went to school in New York, I became acquainted with people such as this Reverend James Robinson in New York that came to speak to our school. And he mentioned this Crossroads Africa as a program that every year would allow 300 students from all across the United States and Canada to go into different countries in Africa and work with the young people in those cultures and talk with them about our similarities and the things that we can learn from each other. It was actually a forerunner of the Peace Corps, and that's how Kennedy got his idea and formulated the Peace Corps after that. Robinson started his Crossroads Africa in 57, and I went to Tanzania, which was at the time
Tanganyika, right?
Tanganyika it was originally. It turned into Tanzania because it absorbed Zanzibar and Tanganyika, and that's how it got its other name. Anyway, it was quite a fantastic experience to be able to interface with a number of people and have some very hard questions asked. But it gave me a lot more political awareness of what was happening in different parts of the world. And I came back to the University of Oklahoma and became more immersed in a lot of different communities there than just being in the sorority world. Mm-hmm. And I would spend some time, spend evenings in good discussions, wonderful discussions, with people, the international African students that were on campus. So it was a good learning experience for me.
Well, that was the first time I had ever heard the origin story of getting over to Tanzania for Crossroads Africa. I didn't realize all the historical background, but
well, there's a little bit more that goes with that. In order to join, be a part of Crossroads Africa, you have to say that you present discussions and conversations with people before and after you came back from that country and tell of your experience, so that you were kind of disseminating information. Mm-hmm. So I gave 45 speeches after I returned from Africa to the the various men's clubs and women's clubs and the library club and anyone that we could find that would want to talk with us. And so that gave me more of a chance to kind of get other people interested in how the world is coming together in more ways.
That's cool. So while you were telling that story, Dad went in and out of the garage a couple times, and you need to put some WD-40 on that door.
We have to put new cables on it.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah.
But it's a perfect segue into telling me about how you and Dad met, because it was about this time in your life in college that...
Right. People who left Oklahoma to go off to the East Coast to school would always keep contact with one another and go visit one another. So I was at school in New York, and my good friend Larry went to school in New Haven, Connecticut. And as a result of that, he called me up and said, hey, let's have a double date. You get some girl and I have a roommate. And so we went on a double date with my buddy from Oklahoma City and his roommate, Bob Buchanan. And then, so Bob asked Larry, do you mind if I go out with that girl if she is no longer your interest for the moment? So Larry said, okay. We've known each other for years. And so Bob asked me out. We had a good time. We talked and talked and talked. And then we saw each other off and on for a year. Then I went back to Oklahoma. That was my third year in college that I went back to Oklahoma. He decided to surprise me and come out for a visit in Oklahoma. And it was just when I was headed off with a group of guys and girls to Aspen to go skiing. So he knocked on the door and I said, come in, come in. And then I saw him that evening and I took off because I'd made a commitment and it was my car that was driving us all up there. So that was not a great romantic moment in our history.
Well, and did you meet your parents? Because he said he threw up. He was so nervous.
He came over for dinner, and he literally would just stir the food on the plate. And my mother's whole aspect of whether you like her or not is how much you like her cooking. Mm-hmm. And she just loves to cook. Mm-hmm. So he tried to eat, and he tried to hide it and whatever. But it was just his nervous moment in history. And then after that, I went back to Oklahoma, and we kept touch as often as possible. And then I went to Washington, D.C. as an intern for the summer between my junior and senior year, and saw a lot of Bob. I was working for the Office of Mexican Affairs at the State Department. So I spent basically 3 months of the summer seeing Bob Buchanan, my husband.
And he's such a straight and narrow Navy guy, and you're wild and crazy.
Wild and crazy, just a little bit more serendipitous.
Okay, so you and Dad have been madly in love and married for 55 years, which is really rare in this day. And so I'm wondering to all of our, you know, dozen listeners out there, maybe 100 or so, what is your marriage advice for how to keep it going with such joie de vivre?
I think first and foremost, there had to be a real respect for one another, for one another's thoughts, ideas, opinions. And sometimes when the opinions, when you can feel that the sense of passion is going to have a little bit less give and take, then I think that you have to step back and to accept another way of thinking as just as good as your own. I think the main thing for me about my relationship with Bob is that he is a rock. He is my rock. And he, because of his groundedness, it allows me to perhaps go out on a limb from time to time. Pardon?
To be a peacock and strut your stuff?
Not necessarily, but I just mean that to be able to be a little bit more out there, and to also to give him a little bit of a lighter side of life. Because yeah. I think it's also good to have the sense of opposites. The opposites attract, but to have two people that are same could get pretty boring. And yeah. You don't be boring in a 55-year relationship.
No, definitely not boring. And you both have very dominant personalities. Like, you both really like to be heard. And one of my really good friends described a dinner conversation at the Buchanan's as verbal Hunger Games. Like, like, to get a word in, you literally have to like pound the table and say, "I got something to say."
Well, it makes me think about Bob's family, in that his mother and father enjoyed having their conversations with the kids. And the youngest one, Janie, would always, at the end of the evening, get upset and almost start crying, because she said, "I had a lot of things to say and no one let me say it." And so, you know, you have to just get out there when you can.
Well, I was, you know, my two sisters are 6 and 8 years older than me. And so I was an only child from eighth grade through end of high school. And most people would see me as being quite talkative, like almost annoyingly so. And yet you and Dad are on a whole other level, where you thought I couldn't even speak, because you and him would interrupt each other the whole dinner conversation. And then you would turn to me at the end and go like, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you saying anything? I was like, I can't even get in there. Like, it's impossible. So
I know. But we're happy that you're still verbal. We are. We really are.
Okay, so you and Dad graduate from college. You get married literally a couple of months later, and then you immediately get on a plane or a ship to go to Japan and live on a naval base, Sasebo, for 3 years. No, there must have been a couple years in between there, but
this one. So we got married, and it was the summer after I graduated from college. But let me say, as a precursor to that, that for me, I had had a whole lot of adventure that gave me a sense of my own independence and self-worth before I ever got married, so that I felt that I really could have a little bit more of a settled life, a married life, because I had gone to New York. Was the first great step out of my world, my insular world that I had lived in Oklahoma City. And then from there, I spent that summer in Africa. And then from that point, I came back to my origins again and felt the grounding of that. And then went off to the Institute of European Studies in Vienna, Austria, where I really got further international exposure again. And each of those experiences, I had to put forth my case to my parents because they did not have a great deal of expendable income. So when it came to going to New York to school, my second year, I got a partial scholarship to stay because most of my friends who left Oklahoma to go to a two-year college, be it, they were just supposed to stay for a year and then come back and make their home in Oklahoma City or Oklahoma somewhere. So I helped to pay for that aspect of college. Then I raised all the money for going on Crossroads Africa. Mm-hmm. And then came back to Oklahoma. And in order to go to Vienna, Austria, which was, I think, around $15,000 plus living expenses, which weren't much at the time, I had to show them that going to school in Oklahoma was $1,300 for a semester. And for just $200 more, I could have an experience such as this. So I was always very pragmatic. And also, as you say, that you were the most cost, that you were the least expensive child that we had raised, that I had to feel that same sense because I couldn't expect things from my parents otherwise. Mm-hmm. So anyway, when I got into married life, I was thinking that I might be pretty much settling into a particular way of life, but that was not the case because Bob was in the Navy. And we started out for the first few months in Norfolk, Virginia, where he was commissioning an aircraft carrier called the USS America. It's one of the largest aircraft carriers in the United States, at least. And then, so we were there 6 months, and then he was accepted into the Chinese language program in Washington, D.C. So while he was in the language program, I got a job with Congressman Ed Edmondson from Oklahoma and worked for his office at the House Rayburn Office Building. So that was a really interesting time for me, and one in which I felt like I was learning a lot, and I was also helping him with his Chinese language studies. In the meantime, I became pregnant, and Shannon came into our life during that period of time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we took off for Japan. So,
and you learned how to speak Japanese pretty fluently, and you really, I think that was a pretty formative time in your life. I think what I remember is that you got pretty immersed in the culture and in the kind of the simplicity of beautiful design and the Zen Buddhist rock gardens and all of that I was exposed to when you took the whole family and me when I was 12 back to Japan to check.
Well, yes, but that you're there for 3 years at that time, and it was on a small island of Kyushu, not the main island. So you were in a fairly rural place, and we would we could go into the various countryside and speak with people, learn about their ceramics. I took through the University of Maryland language program that was offered on the base, Japanese, so that I could converse in very elementary terms with people. But I just have always felt that trying to make an effort to speak in the culture that you're living in is very, very important. Even though it might be a tragic pronunciation, it still helps. They feel appreciative that you care.
Yeah, absolutely. So we just have two questions left, but one of them is pretty loaded with a lot of ways you can go. What is the hardest, most painful lesson you've been confronted with in these three areas of your business, your personal life, and in community efforts?
Well, I think I would probably start off with business and say that to a fault, I had a circumstance. Artist Circle Limited Fine Art is a very small company with four or five of us working employees as well as myself. I was basically doing everything except I had an administrative assistant who was taking care of the mail and the phone calls and all of those things just to keep everything running smoothly. And I was making presentations, going on appointments, doing installations, interfacing with artists, and all of the other aspects of things. So I just happened to feel that I should go down to, and my company was in the lower level of our house. So I went down to on the weekend to go over all of the payables and the receivables. And in doing so, I found that this particular administrative assistant had taken 6 months of IRS demands for payment on our sales tax that had not been submitted, and that there were huge mounting penalties and fees that were coming due. And so the most arduous thing that has ever happened in my life is having to go through the IRS audit to square that away. And that was just something that it makes you feel the need to be as hands-on as possible in every aspect of your company's business.
Yeah, that's a good lesson for us all you have to have checks and balances in place on the financial front, even if you're not in the weeds yourself. But yeah, it's hard to trust someone in the finance front after you've been burned like that.
Yep, true. I would say in the community aspect of things, I was on a board of a nature group, and this was quite some time ago. And there, I really believed in certain aspects of their mission. But when they started getting, to my mind's eye, a little bit myopic regarding advocacy role, whereby they wanted to interfere with or stop any form of regional transportation needs that is very vital aspect of our community. It's just the traffic concerns, both within Maryland, Virginia, and DC, are very important. And so they were kind of anti-growth, anti-everything. And although I feel that growth should be in a logical and considered way, I went at cross purposes, and that made me a little uncomfortable with that organization at that time. They have since changed their leadership, and we are extremely supportive of what they're doing.
And that may have led you to, because you were on the Nature Conservancy board for a while, and they've always been very partner-centric with the business community and things like that.
Right, and they try to see all sides of things and find a road that is a win-win for everyone. They have a good concept. With regard to personal, I would say that one of the early difficult aspects of our married life was living in Japan and Bob being in the security and intelligence aspect of the Navy and would have to go on missions whereby I would never know exactly when he was slated to go on a mission. He would be away for 2 to 3 months and I would never know when he was coming back. So it was the kind of thing where raising two small children, 1 year and 3 years old, or 6 months and a year and a half, it was kind of a time when you had to rely on the community around you to help you become the larger family element. So you would go through holidays without having him there. And in fact, I have to say, as I was thinking about this whole thing, many, many other families have had to deal with that too. And it really gives you a sense that you're not in this boat by yourself. You just have to find a way to provide a lot of different spheres of comfort for the family when you're having to be all things to them. But we had a great extended community in that base that we lived on. And so that was very helpful.
Yeah, that would be hard. I have not had to experience that with Shannon, so I don't envy the months apart and the not knowing. I feel like this whole coronavirus and the unknown of when we'll get back to the new normal and all of that is, you know, my generation and then my kids' generation, you know, we're not used to not knowing for a long periods of time because the internet tells us everything. And so we have information and kind of stability right at our fingertips.
I really, truly feel that there will be good coming out of this coronavirus because I do feel that you put your finger on a very key element that we're all going to have to understand what patience and time is going to do to readjust our own thinking on life and the way we will live and the meanings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so last question is, tell us something that we wouldn't already know about you, some life moment from the past that shaped who you are now. So it's, you know, where you think that, it's not a surprise that I am where I am now because of this big thing that happened in my life.
You know, you took the wind out of my sails because my big moment was being able to be a caregiver to my mother when she came to live with us for 11 years. And I think that that is something I never would have anticipated, but I also feel that I could not have done it without the huge support of Bob because, and there are so many things that you have to look at in your life that tie together what makes something doable in the present. And that was, as we have talked about in the past, that Bob's mother and father had the opportunity to have his grandmother live with them. So Bob's mother's mother came to live with them when her husband died. And when she then would have to find a new place to live on her own. And so they surrounded her with their family, and she came up. And so it was very normal for him to have another generation in the house. Mm-hmm. Now, what was not totally normal was to have four generations in a house. And it was so when my mother lived with us, that was an adjustment for everyone, but we all realized that that takes place just like we're having to on this coronavirus. But then when Bob's family could no longer take Grandmother Dot in, we took her to our house. And Bob said four generations of, well, I think he was saying that having two older ladies in the house that might come to cross purposes with one another was not always easy. And that's why we didn't think you could talk, because they were all talking at the dinner table.
It was mainly you and Dad.
Okay. Anyway, though, having that, it was mainly a blessing, though, because as a result of my mom coming to live with us, I felt that my children were so enriched beyond anything that your friends might have gotten. And they, your friends would all, Aunt Kirsten and Shannon's friends would love to come over and go in and say hi to Grams and just make her happy. It just would thrill her, make her day.
Yeah. Yeah, she was a special woman. She was a lot of fun to tease, but also to hear her stories. And she was just sweet through and through. Just the sweetest thing you ever did meet.
Well, she had a lot of Oklahoma colloquialisms too.
Yeah.
That you picked up more than anyone.
Yeah. If you made her really mad, she'd say, for garden seed.
Yeah. And so you had to ponder on that. Ponder on that comment?
Yeah.
And I bet you did.
Yeah. Well, Mom, that was super fun. And you are now joining the cause and effect community of other people interviewed that are really fun too. But
well, I have to say that I have thoroughly enjoyed hearing from your friends and business associates, because it's the thing that gives us all so much hope that they will continue to enrich our societies with all that they do.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we will talk again very soon, because we talk pretty much every day.
And well, we're doing Grace tonight.
Yeah, happy Grace's birthday. 18th birthday, and we have a family Zoom call for that in this new world.
True. Is it 8 o'clock?
Your time, 5 o'clock mine. But yeah, we'll be talking then.
All right, hon.
Okay.
Take care.
Love you. Bye.